Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Anya Palmer, and this is New Books in Music, a podcast of the New Books Network. Today, I'm talking to Professor Jennifer Saltstein, author of Song, Landscape, and Identity in Medieval Northern France, Towards an Environmental History. Published just this year by Oxford University Press, this book interprets nature imagery in true vers song in light of an environmental history and offers a new, ecologically informed context for the exploration of identity formation in the period. Jennifer, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today and welcome to the podcast. So just to get us started, would you like to introduce yourself and maybe tell us a little bit about your work and your background?
Sure. As you said, my name is Jennifer Saltstein. I'm a medieval musicologist, but I've always specialized in not just music, but also literature and interrelationships between music and literature in the medieval period. I teach at a school of music in the University of Oklahoma, and I teach music from the ancient world all the way through the Baroque, so covering kind of a wide berth. And I've always in my scholarship and my approach to teaching both tried to integrate the history of music into just the history of human beings. I've always been interested in social history, in how people interact with works of art in various time periods. And so that perspective informs what I do in both teaching and scholarship. My published works have ranged somewhat widely. They all tend to focus on the music and literature of France, mostly in the 13th century and lopping into the 14th century, what we often will call the long 13th century. If my published works have covered a wide array of different types of genres, different types of music and literature. The work I was doing as I was coming up as an assistant professor, a lot of it was about citation, intertextuality. So basically, any time when we find a song quoted in a book or a little portion of a motet, a polyphonic work quoted somewhere else in another song or a work of literature. And I was fascinated by tracing those interrelationships between music and literature, music within itself, these kind of systems of reference. The reason that fascinated me was that often these works were anonymous, but the interrelationship between them would suggest communities that were interacting with these works. So it was always a way to get at people and how people were engaged with music and literature during the Middle Ages. Lately, I've been looking at, as you say, questions of environment and the natural landscape and how that figures into medieval song. Even as I do that, and I'm very interested in plants and trees and nature, I'm always also still looking for the human, looking for the ways people are describing their relationship with the natural world in song, what those relationships actually were on the ground. Those are questions that are informing my work now. But at heart, I'm always kind of wanting to do a social history of music. That's always what I'm aiming for. And so that's been a kind of constant throughout my work.
Thanks. That's such a fabulous introduction to your work. And I think far more coherent than I ever could have put it myself. I gave my own kind of brief description of what this new book about is about. Could you talk about it yourself in a little bit more detail?
Sure. So the book is called Song, Landscape, and Identity in Medieval Northern France. It treats a specific geography and a specific time period. So the north of France, areas that are currently in Belgium, to some degree, the Low Countries. The time period is late 12th through early 14th century. What I wanted to get at, the title is very descriptive. The title tells us a lot about what's in this book, is that I wanted to think about people and the songs they wrote that described natural landscapes. And I wanted to think about how those natural landscapes they described related to the landscapes they inhabited. What was the land like where they lived? Is the way they described it accurate? Does it reflect their own experiences on the land? Is it related to previous literature? Is it a trope that's sort of coming back that they're imitating? Where are they getting it, basically? In asking that question, I also wanted to think about, why are they doing it? Why are they describing natural landscapes, placing themselves on them? And doing that was a way of thinking about how land relates to identity and how people configure their identity in part as a relationship to a specific place. So thinking through that question across a wide variety of medieval genres is something I found productive and interesting. The time period that this book covers, as I found as I started reading environmental history, written by actual environmental historians whose work I find absolutely fascinating, it's a period of climatic change. And so it was interesting to think about relationships between landscape and identity and how those related to broader changes historically in the way the climate was actually behaving. So those are the questions that motivated the book. And I explore all these through song because song is what I love best.
That's fantastic. And I wonder, you've mentioned identity a couple of times, and of course, obviously it plays a really important part in this book. Could you talk about how you define the concept of identity in relationship to kind of, you know, 13th century subjects and subjectivity?
Yeah, so I found 13th century identity really fascinating. And my work on this is especially informed by an article written by Carolyn Walker Bynum in 1980. It's an oldie but a goodie. It's been cited hundreds of times. People have found it just terribly insightful. And this article is called, Did the 12th Century Discover the Individual? And so this is set against the backdrop of a previous scholarship that had really wanted to say that there was a renaissance in the 12th century, that the renaissance was not just something that happened in the, you know, 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, but actually, you know, there was a renaissance in the 12th century, that people saw a new kind of introspection in 12th century works, a new focus on the self. So there was a desire among earlier scholarship to pull back that notion of renaissance subjectivity into the Middle Ages. Well, Bynum said, no, there's something quite different going on in the 12th century. And what's going on there, it's fascinating. What she says, she describes very convincingly the way in which people in this time thought about identity in terms of their relationship to others, the way that they really strongly desired to mold their own identity in the image of others who they admired. And that is kind of the overriding sense in which people think of the South at that time. And those concepts, I feel, are still very much at play in the 13th century. My concrete example of how this works in my context is that the manuscripts that transmit a bunch of the songs that I look at, particularly those written by knights, knights are a big figure in my book, and so a lot of my songwriters were knights. Well, in these songbooks, will give you a little author portrait of the person whose song you're encountering in the manuscript. And so for knights, almost always, for the 13th century Northern French songbooks, the knights are almost always pictured on horseback in full armor. Some of them, you know, with their swords drawn, they're ready to lunge. And these are the images that precede often love lyrics that are, you know, terribly romantic in many ways. And so I hadn't thought a lot about that. There was a famous book by Sylvia Hewitt, From Song to Book, which dwelt on the imagery of these songbooks and these knights. But I came across some references to medieval seals. And so that's when my thinking about these things really changed. I read a book by Brigitte Bezos-Rezac, which blew my mind. It was fascinating. But it was all about medieval seals and articulated very similar kind of concepts of identity, looked at how the seal imagery of the knight on horseback became just kind of part and parcel of how the knighthood thought of themselves, how they represented themselves. They would, of course, use these seals to stamp their signature. If they were illiterate, they were sort of an extension of their body. And that they also seemed to kind of bring the person to life in their absence, that the seal was somehow directly kind of implicated in their embodied person. They would press their fingerprints into it. They would put little bits of hair into it. I mean, I thought this was all just fascinating. But so that sort of made me view that songbook imagery very differently, that these author portraits of these knights were representing these knights in exactly the same way as their seals did, as knights on horseback, and that they were a kind of extension of their identity. They're strikingly uniform, and this is where medieval identity is quite different from modern identity, that there's in fact a desire to conform to an ideal image, and that a lot of people in this time worked very hard to embody an ideal image of the identity they wished to inhabit. So in so many ways, it's sort of the opposite of the current culture. The current culture around identity, it seems to me, as, you know, an outsider and a middle-aged person, is all about kind of carefully curating by collating materials from the web an absolutely unique vision of the self, and then projecting that unique image outward. It couldn't be more different. This is all about finding an ideal model and working very hard to conform oneself to kind of join with that ideal model and be a perfect embodiment of it. So very, very different ways of thinking about identity. And this doesn't manifest in the same way with every individual that I look at from this time period. There are people in my book I discuss who don't conform to the kind of set variety of identities that are available to them in interesting ways. But for me, it was very productive to think through the works of those other medievalists that are encouraging us to make sure we realize that there were very different conceptions of identity at that time.
That's so interesting. And I love how you kind of draw that comparison between the conformity of the past, or maybe a slightly more conformist vision, and the kind of individuality that we tend to emphasize in the present. I know you talked already about the knightly class and how important they are in your book. Could you talk a bit about clerics and their place in your project and in the kind of world of 13th century song making in general?
Sure. So clerics, this is a term that referred very generally to people who were strongly attached to the church in one way or another. I say strongly, some of them worked for the church. Cleric is a term that describes, you know, people all the way up the hierarchy, bishops, cardinals, all of those folks. It's also a term for students who are basically enrolled in cathedral schools or universities for their learning. So it's a pretty broad group of people. It's a group of people that musicologists always need to be interested in the Middle Ages, because they're the most highly musically literate people of this time. And so they're very strongly implicated in the production of the notated records of music that survive. So we ignore them at our peril, I guess I would say. I've always thought they were very interesting, and I came across them early on in my work because I was interested in a composer named Adam de la Halle, who was a 13th century music composer, songwriter, also one of the very first vernacular playwrights who survives from the tradition. So someone who'd always been an important figure, and who was believed to be a cleric, presented an image of himself as a cleric. And so often this particular composer was pointed to as kind of an early author figure in the vernacular, and viewed as kind of important in the history of French music. But as I read more about him, I found that he was one of kind of a large group of clerical author figures, many others like him who were lesser known, who were kind of educated by the church or associated with the church, but who wrote songs, often wrote love songs, which I found a little curious, to be honest, that these churchmen were kind of writing these love songs in their spare time. So it's a group I'd always been interested in. And to look at kind of major figures who fit this mold, and then to be guided into a series of lesser known clerical composers from this era, was to kind of uncover a little world and a little community that I was always very interested in. So this book actually started, it was going to be a history of clerical songwriters. That's how I got into the topic. But I quickly realized there were these other themes that I wanted to address that their work spoke to. So it kind of grew from that original germ. But yes, I've always been interested in these churchmen and students kind of writing these songs on the side in the vernacular as they're learning their Latin, reading their Ovid and all of this, still kind of have their hand in this other musical world than the one they're training in.
Just because you've just mentioned it now, could you talk a little bit more about the journey from your first book, which, as you already discussed, is about kind of refrains and citation in the vernacular, and onto this project that's very much embedded in environmental history. And could you speak a little bit more about how that kind of interest came about and what you were writing in between?
Sure. Yeah. So I had intended after my first book to write this book about these clerical songwriters. And actually it came from the outside in certain ways, that my humanities center on campus at the University of Oklahoma, they created a new program and we're going to have a seminar, and that they were going to choose a topic every year. And the first topic they chose was environment. And so, I kind of looked at the call and I thought, oh, rats, I don't work on that at all. I can't do this. And then I went back to what I was doing with my clerical songwriters. And of course, I saw that all of my songs were set in the outdoors. They were all, kind of imbued with nature imagery. So it's a kind of thing that had been in plain sight, but I hadn't noticed it and hadn't thought about it in that way. And so it was because of that, participating in that seminar with other humanists, thinking about, issues of environment very broadly. That's what kind of got me thinking about this and got me started on a path to thinking more carefully about what that nature imagery was, where it was coming from, what was informing it, all of those questions.
Fantastic. And you've already mentioned them, but could you tell us a little bit more about the songbooks and the songbooks that you're particularly interested in, and the kind of source material from which the songs you're discussing are coming from.
Sure. So I work on a tradition that usually by scholars is called trouvère song. And that word trouvère is not really used very much in the Middle Ages. It's a kind of modern generic marker that we put on these songs. These are songs that are written in the style of the troubadours of the south of France, usually better known for writing love songs in their mother tongue, wildly influential, you know, continuously from the Middle Ages to the present, shaped ideas of courtly love that are with us to this day. And so the tradition I look at is the Northern French version of that love song tradition. We find it in a collection of a couple of dozen kind of central sources. Many of these are luxury books, songbooks of, you know, a couple hundred pages written on parchment, adorned with gold leaf and decoration. These were beautiful objects that, according to John Haynes, could cost a noble family as much as a country house. Some of these survive. And so we've got these, you know, carefully housed in European libraries. These have now been digitized and so are available to consult for anyone who's curious to look at them. There are very few that have not been digitized now. So those books form my central source base. There are also more fragmentary sources. There are songs that are kind of jotted into the margins of other manuscripts. These have kind of informed this work as well. But those songbooks are central to this repertoire that we study. And it's a very large repertoire. It's well over 100 songs. I would say only a fraction of those have been, you know, seriously studied or even, you know, performed. So it's a rich repertoire that still has much to offer us.
That's great. And yeah, I'd love to just kind of just discuss the book itself and all the richness. And it goes over three main sections. And I know in your very first, you kind of lay out, as you say in the book, I believe you lay out the land for your readers. And you give a really detailed account in your first chapter of what is actually happening to the landscape and environment in medieval northern France at the time. And you've mentioned this already, but could you talk in a little bit more detail about, I guess, what is happening to the climate at the time and also the kind of environmental history and field of knowledge that you're exploring in this chapter as well?
Sure. Environmental history is fascinating, and it's in, for the medieval period, a very advanced state, thanks especially to the work of Richard Hoffman and Bruce Campbell in particular. They've written these magisterial works of environmental history that tell us so much about the Middle Ages. I'm very indebted to them and the works of other environmental historians who can tell us all kinds of things that are just, to me, fascinating. What's the regulation of hunting and fishing in the Middle Ages? What is the state of the soil in northern France? And how does this impact which crops are produced? What is the state of the climate itself? This is work that informed that first chapter of the book. What I can say about it is that across this long 13th century, it's a really interesting time period in human history. And so what we can say, just painting in very broad strokes, is this is a time of enormous population growth. The population of Europe expands really breathtakingly. in northern France, from the beginning of the century to the end, I think it's from the 10th century to the end of my period, there's overall, I think, a tripling of the population in my region. So very, very significant. It's a time of urbanization. So it's a time in which cities are growing, where we have universities cropping up, all over Europe. populations in cities constantly increasing. Those cities are getting built up. So Paris famously is kind of outgrowing its original walls and needing new walls to accommodate all of its inhabitants and the structures that house them. So all of that is contributing overall to various measures of human flourishing. There is greater peace and stability at this time than in earlier eras in the Middle Ages. There have been efficiencies in the production of food that are in part spurring on that population growth. And this has a variety of causes. It has to do with tools, but it also has to do with the management of agriculture, which is, you know, in various ways, improving yields. These environmental historians tell us that the 13th century is just a period of an unparalleled flourishing in many ways, that by many different markers in this geographical era that I'm looking at, there are just more people doing better in more different ways at this time. One of the reasons, there are many causes, and these environmental historians are quick to point this out, that it would be wrong to take what they would call an environmentally determinist view. But one of the causes is that the climate is very stable at this time. So they're in the middle of what's called the medieval climate anomaly. This goes by different terms. This is the term that's used by Hoffman and Campbell. Where basically atmospheric conditions are fairly settled, where winters are mild and rainy. This is really great for crops. So it's what they call a kind of climatically favored age, an age in which these conditions are one of many factors that are contributing to human flourishing. That's sort of part of the backdrop of this book.
And you're then kind of doing this, in this great move, you're connecting this to the nature opening, which occurs so often in Trouvère and I think earlier in Troubadour's song as well. And could you just describe this a little bit and talk about where you see that relationship?
Sure. So a lot of love songs from this time begin with the songwriter describing how they're going out into a natural landscape. They're walking out into a field or walking into a meadow. They are looking out over a kind of vista where they can see, you know, woods, they can see pastures, they can see meadows, they can sort of see lots of different types of land in front of them. They go out, they smell the beautiful kind of scents of springtime. They feel a gentle breeze come across them. They may hear birdsong, and all of this inspires them to sing. So this is something that occurs again and again, as you say, in Troubadour song, across Trouvère song, across many different genres. It's kind of a very recognizable trope that occurs in music at this time. And so it's something that I spend a lot of time with in the book. It's something that had been viewed as formulaic, basically, that there was a sort of a generation of really brilliant linguistic analysis of French poetry, really wonderful and fascinating work by people like Paul Zumthor, for example, the French theorist. As brilliant as that work was, and as much as I admire it, I think it gave short shrift to this nature opening, viewed it as kind of mechanically recycled, as not, terribly interesting or worth pondering. What I found as I looked closer at these nature openings is that they are differentiated, Knightly Trouvères use them differently than clerkly Trouvères, that some songwriters intentionally write against it, they parody it, or they write it in ways that are unique and seem to reflect their own biographies, their own experiences. So I started from the premise, I guess, that I wanted to take these things seriously and encounter them with an open mind.
Could you talk a little bit about the differences you found between the more knightly approaches to the nature opening and the clerical approaches?
Sure. So I guess I'll start with the clerics, and I'll say that a lot of these figures, but not all of them, a lot of them were urban. And so a lot of them were writing from the city. And so the ones I look at often were from the city of Arras, which is a city in northern France. There are also those who write from Paris, so other kind of urban locations. A lot of those clerical trouvères don't use it at all, or they make fun of it. And so there are songs where they're kind of, you know, poking fun at this gesture, and they say, or they say, this doesn't work for me, this doesn't inspire me. So they're very self-consciously write against it. And so that was something I found striking, that either they were writing against it or it was completely absent from a corpus of, you know, a considerable corpus of songs where we might expect to find it. The knightly songwriters, they love this. So we find this kind of writ large across the songs of Gaspe Brulé, one of the most beloved songwriters of this time. And we find it, you know, used mostly very earnestly, you know, and with great feeling and great specificity and kind of depth and texture. So great variety across the songs of these knightly songwriters. And then there are some also who use it sort of wistfully, as though not fully identifying with it, but wanting to. And what I quickly realized looking at these, as you look across them, that they very clearly describe the kind of ideal estate landscape. So the land that was the desired endpoint of knightly violence, of knightly political jockeying, at the endpoint of all of that, at the endpoint of advantageous marriages, lies land in a particular configuration. It's the source of wealth. It's the source of status. It is a desired endpoint of all knightly activity in some sense. And so I found, how would I describe this? I guess I would say that the songs really did speak to that aspect of knightly identity in ways that seemed very clear.
Can you talk a little bit more on, I guess, land ownership in particular? And I'm thinking, I know you do a wonderful job of connecting. I believe Gaspe Brulé was a landowner. Correct me if I'm wrong in remembering that. I'm also thinking of maybe Thibaut of Navarre. And the realities of, you know, as you've kind of already alluded to, the estates owned by these trouvères and the kind of activities that they would enjoy doing as landowners and how they might have thought of nature in a kind of knightly way.
Yeah. So Gaspe Brulé, he had an estate near Dreux. There are records of this. These are records not found by me. They've been known about for some time. Thibaut de Navarre, he had vast land holdings. I mean, really extraordinary amounts of land under his control of. So that would have been, you know, very central. These knights, once they were in control of land, they're in charge of administering it. They need to manage it. They need to make sure that it's producing everything that will meet their needs. So it will occupy them at some point. We often don't know when they came in possession of this land. So we'll have records that they possess it. We occasionally have records that they've sold it, as for example, with Raoul de Soissons, who was a crusading knight. And like many crusaders, the last thing you do before you leave is you raise money, and for the kind of lesser among them who didn't have as much cash on hand, that often involved painful departures with land. So we have records of him selling his vineyards, for example, before he goes on crusade. It's central, and this is a very well worked out area of research by people like John Baldwin, people like Richard Cowper, who've written just such richly textured histories of these knightly cultures. And I found these really fascinating to read. But what those scholars will say is that there are record books that very clearly record the names of these knights, battles that they've fought in, and the land that they've been given. It's all, kind of intimately connected there. The landowning is important. It's an important part of knightly identity and knightly aspiration.
And your fifth chapter discusses the pastorelle, which I know is a genre you've written about before. And can you just explain to listeners what the pastorelle is and maybe how you're dealing with it in this chapter and in your previous work?
Sure. So the pastorelle is a song genre from the Middle Ages, of which we have several hundred examples. And many examples feature an encounter between a knight who's riding out in the countryside and a young peasant woman that he encounters. And often she's a shepherdess. Often she will have her sheep with her. She's kind of out tending a flock. And so what will ensue between them is dialogue always. So there's always a kind of conversation that happens. Often the knight claims he's sort of taken with her, falls for her, wants to seduce her. And he will often do this by promising gifts, promising marriage, all kinds of things. Sometimes she will assent to this and they will go off in the bushes together. sometimes she will resist it. Sometimes she will call upon her friends who will come and rescue her. If they have strength in numbers, she and her other peasant buddies can chase off this knight on horseback. There are instances in which very clearly he rapes her, and it's unambiguous, described often in pretty disturbing detail. So there are kind of a wide range of outcomes that can happen. This is one of a small number of medieval song types that medieval people clearly recognized, that the people who compiled our songbooks occasionally write this designation, pastorelle, to indicate the genre. So it's one that they were aware of. Musically, it's incredibly diverse. So we have this narrative type that will emerge in a wide variety of different song types, short songs, long songs, songs that have refrains at the end of each verse, songs that have a different refrain at the end of each verse. We find it in polyphony, in the genre of the motet, which has many voices sounding together in harmony. And we will find some of the voices carrying this truncated versions of this same narrative. So it's an interesting genre and a very diverse one. It's always kind of been in the background of my work. So in my first book, I was interested in this genre in part to watch these refrains that would occur at the end of verses. And I would see that these would be quoted in other places. And so I wanted to look at the relationships between songs that were sharing the same refrain and were using the pastorelle narrative, sometimes to kind of suggest different outcomes for this little story. So I was looking at it there in that book. In this book, I was really interested in thinking about the landscape that's described. Where is she when he finds her? What does this landscape look like? It's usually very specific in the songs. So they will describe in detail whether she is by a road, whether she is in a fallow field, whether she is near a coppice. A coppice is a place where basically people have cut trees down to the ground so that they'll sprout or sucker, and then they can harvest poles of kind of long, skinny poles of wood to make fences or any, handles for tools, all kinds of things. So these songs are kind of breathtakingly specific about these landscapes and these patterns of land usage. So I really wanted to think more about that and what that was saying about these people, these types that are placed on the landscape in these songs.
And I guess without putting too much pressure on you to have a kind of new discovery about the Pastorelle, but did you find that you kind of started thinking about it differently, thinking about it in, you know, this kind of direct context of the environment and through questions of identity, as well as just the kind of more narrative aspects of the Pastorelle?
Yes, I would say that this chapter, not to be immodest, but this chapter, I would say, is a kind of radical reversal of the way that the landscape was read in this genre in previous accounts by literary scholars. There was a tendency to say that basically that these songs were occurring in what would have been a kind of suburban hinterland outside of a city, but not the kind of wild and rough forest. So somewhere that was kind of remote enough from the castle to escape the prying eyes of courtiers who might see the knight's poor behavior, but not exactly in the wildness of the woods, etc. So what I found as I really started investigating through the work of environmental historians, what these landscapes actually were, how they were related to the land as it was at this time. What I found is that, well, first of all, the first thing I found was that the landscapes described in the song were somewhat nostalgic in the sense that they described land use practices that were in the recent past. They described a kind of patchwork of different land uses, all in close proximity to one another, where you had a pasture right next to a field of wheat, right next to, orchards, right next to, other things of this nature. And that, in fact, at the time my songs were being written, there was field consolidation that was becoming more common, where basically you had a large communal field and everyone would kind of have their plot on the communal field. Everyone knew where their plot was, but you didn't need roads anymore in between them. Everything was all consolidated into one. So this landscape of the Pastorelle, where you had kind of roads crisscrossing through these different types of land usage, it was the landscape of the grandfathers of the people who wrote these songs. It wasn't their landscape. It was something that was kind of in recent memory. The other thing that I found is that these landscapes were symbolic. They were interrelated with the identities of the characters in very interesting ways. And so the knight was almost always associated with the forest, and that was because of the knightly association with hunting. That forests were kind of the ultimate knightly status symbol. Hunting in a forest was kind of the ultimate, aspiration of knights. It was something they considered sort of intrinsic to the identity they actually inhabited or the one they wanted to. So very, very strongly associated there. And often in these songs, the knight is strongly associated with that forest landscape. The shepherdess, on the other hand, when I looked across these traditions, she, in many of the songs, will be very aptly associated with fields, with, the kinds of landscapes where you expect to find people pasturing. But what I found is that in those songs in which the shepherdess is raped, often she's in the forest. She's in the forest, she's with her sheep. And what I learned from environmental historians is that that was a big no-no. That was, in fact, illegal often, that you never would want to bring sheep into a forest because they did enormous damage to the trees. And so there were only certain animals that people were allowed to pasture in the forest. So in fact, these songs were very sensitive to identity and how identity related to landscape, and that certain authors were clearly using those associations to signal the coming of a transgression. And so this is a very different way of looking at these songs that was only possible for me after having immersed myself in the work of environmental historians to really understand how these landscapes were managed at the time. So yes, I would say that that's an intervention in the field.
It's such a fascinating perspective to kind of bring the texture of these different kinds of spaces. I want to pick up on something you mentioned about, you know, the landscape being the landscape of their grandfathers rather than a kind of more contemporary landscape. And I wanted to ask you, I guess, about the role nostalgia plays in these songs and in how you're thinking through this project as well.
Yeah, so nostalgia is a fascinating concept to think of here. It's one that it takes a lot of work to get at in this particular corpus. So a lot of the work I did that went into this wasn't just establishing more facts of biography for these different authors in order to kind of place them within a chronology across the long 13th century. And that was really necessary if I wanted to relate what they were doing again to the land that they were living on, because I had to know in greater detail when it was and where it was that they were living. It's only after doing that work that you can really ask, what is the attitude toward the land that we find in these songs? Not just how it's represented, but what is the position of the person vis-a-vis the landscape? So it's only after doing that work that you can really ask, what are they trying to do here? And what is their kind of emotional attachment to this? How do we understand it? And so, yes, in many cases, it does seem as though the attitude is actually nostalgia. It's an ideal that's constructed in the present. And here I'm very influenced by Svetlana Boym's concept of the future orientation of nostalgia. So the way nostalgia can operate here is that a songwriter can construct an idealized vision of the landscape as it was in previous generations in order to project that into the future. And so I look at this in particular in conjunction with the songwriter Raoul de Soissons, this crusading knight who I mentioned earlier, that there's a kind of wistful quality to the nature opening in one of his songs in particular, that I think speaks to the fact that he is someone who is absolutely a knight of great prowess, but someone who also seems to be somewhat downwardly mobile. So when we look at the records of his property transactions and things, it seems as though he's constantly selling off land, borrowing enormous amounts of money from his buddies, that he's someone who kind of marries down in the end after having aspired to marry a countess and seemingly almost pulled it off. Sorry, not a countess, the heir to the kingdom of Jerusalem. So big aspirations in terms of marriage. He winds up marrying, it seems, a woman who was called countess, but may not have had any kind of noble lineage at all. So he seems to take on this pose of the knightly songwriter moved by the landscape in ways that suggest a more fleeting connection to it in actuality. That sort of he's buddies with all these people who embody this ideal, but his own life has kind of not lived up to it in the way he might have hoped. So nostalgia is important here. And it's something we can only get at once we really place these people in history as much as we can, as much as that's possible. I should say too, that these records are much more fragmentary than we'd like in the Middle Ages. There are all kinds of things we'd love to know if people had just kept diaries and left them in a safe place where we could have accessed them. So much of this we have to intuit by looking at the records that do survive and filling in the gaps as best we can.
In your final chapter, you talk about the Ronde, and you particularly talk about gardens and women's experiences. So I guess this is a two-pronged question. And one is, can you talk about this genre and how you're dealing with it, but also what the project of thinking through women's experiences, and I know you also kind of talk about peasant experiences being peripheral maybe to these songs that are all written by highly educated and or aristocratic men in the kind of 12th and 13th and early 14th century, and how you're able to access other kinds of experiences through songs.
Yeah, so this the Ronde, it's a song genre, it's very diverse. So much like the Pastorelle, it has many different musical versions. It's short. It usually has refrains. And in many cases, it highlights the voices of women or the experiences of women. So either women themselves kind of talk or sing in these genres, or we have men describing women who are talking or singing. So women are very present within these short songs. I focused on two main subsets of that repertoire that really do foreground women, and often women in garden settings. This is probably of no surprise to anyone who studied the history of gardens or have been curious about the history of gardens, but gardens were really the domain of aristocratic women. They were given a lot of leeway to design them. They spent a lot of time in them. They're very, very strongly associated with female noble identity. These songs had often been associated with the peasantry, and this has to do with long traditions of wanting to view the refrain, these little bits of song that travel all around in the Middle Ages that I wrote my first book about and that many others have studied, wanting to view those as a vestige of oral song culture. So hoping that those refrains must have been the lost voices of medieval peasants singing songs, the true medieval folk. I think that, well, in my own work, I've suggested that there's good reason to believe that was not the case. And so my first book examined the transmission history of those refrains and found that it was quite literate, quite stable, didn't have the kind of hallmarks of an oral tradition. But that association with those things in peasant culture, I think, inflected the reception of the ronde, this song genre that had these refrains that was talking about medieval women very often. And so I think there was a kind of underlying assumption that these were about peasant women. And so bringing those songs into dialogue with garden history and environmental history, quickly, I think, shows that these settings are often very clearly an aristocratic estate landscape, a garden landscape. And so they do speak to that kind of noble female identity. They are very much kind of obsessed, you might say, with viewing, with the visual dimension. So they often describe, for example, dances occurring. And an onlooker will be watching young women doing a dance, or the women will be talking about being watched. And so there's a kind of dimension of the visual that inflects these things, which is part and parcel of that garden landscape, which was all about sensory pleasure and the pleasure of sight in particular. And so I read some medieval theories of garden design, especially Piero de Crescenzi's very well-known work on this is one of the early works of landscape architecture, and it comes from the early 14th century. But that book is full of instructions about how to curate views in the garden, how you're supposed to experience the garden as especially a delight for the eye. Rethinking that genre within environmental history just focused attention on the ways in which it spoke to female noble identity.
That's fantastic. And just, I guess, at the end of your book and your conclusion, you do talk a little bit about the 14th century. And, as you've kind of explained already, this book deals with maybe the long 13th century or songs that are written in the 12th and 13th century particularly. But how do you see the ways that nature features in music of the 14th century and the kind of events that are happening then as continuous or discontinuous from that of the 13th century?
Yeah, so I'll say first of all that I'm really just focused on one work from the 14th century, and that's Guillaume de Machaut's Remède de Fortune, Fortune's Remedy. Which is a book I've just always loved and often teach. I find it absolutely delightful. It's a book that's been of interest to both musicologists and literary scholars because in the midst of a really fascinating allegorical narrative. There are also songs interspersed within this narrative. The songs span the gamut of genres that were available to people at the time. They seem to tell us something about different notational languages that are coming into use. And so they've been of interest to a wide variety of scholars for this reason. This particular narrative, one of the central as kind of midpoint scenes, takes place in a garden. It's a real garden, the Garden Park of Hesdin. It's a garden that was one of the most elaborate created in the Middle Ages. It's a garden that the author, Guillaume de Machaut, seems to have visited and witnessed firsthand. So it's a kind of intrusion of something very, very real within a narrative that is otherwise bonkers, that's not realistic at all. So I always found that dynamic really interesting. The scene that happens in the midpoint there, it sort of brings back many of the themes of the earlier chapters of the book. Basically, the lover in this scene is underconfident. He needs the help of an allegorical, a personification allegory, a woman named Hope, to kind of teach him a new way of approaching both love and his love relationship and his craft. This all takes place within this idealized landscape that is also a real landscape. It is part and parcel in this narrative of how the lover will come to see himself as a composer. It's sort of crucial to that development of his character. This work is also written by an author, Machaut, who sort of combined both of the identities of the book's third and fourth chapters, I believe. So he is working in a courtly environment that is the heir of the environments in which my knightly songwriters lived and worked. But he is a cleric. He is himself, you know, a trained cleric. He's a notary. He's an almoner, as Elizabeth Leach teaches us, which is the giver of gifts. The giver of gifts, though, this is a role that is tied very closely with male aristocratic identity, going all the way back to the knightly classes of the 12th and 13th centuries. So he kind of combines all of those things all into one figure. So what I ultimately argue is that scene and the treatment of the nature opening in that scene, it reflects these long traditions, it draws on them, and it shows remarkable continuities with earlier centuries, even amid dramatic changes. So if we look at the facts on the ground by this time, by the early 14th century, the medieval climate anomaly is unraveling in spectacularly catastrophic fashion for the people who live, at this time. Basically, climatic patterns are kind of weakening and changing, reorganizing, and it makes weather very unpredictable. For an agrarian society, this is a huge problem. It leads to the Great European Famine, or contributes to. It's not the only cause, but it is a large cause of one of the worst famines in human history. What I argue ultimately about the connection between my cultural artifacts and all of this is that once you have certain images of the land forming landscapes in the minds of artists, once they are kind of cycled through the machine of culture and distributed widely, once people start connecting their own identities to particular kind of landscape configurations, that those things become resistant to change. That once you connect these things to identity, change becomes difficult for people. That what we see is continuity, even when the facts on the ground are changing pretty dramatically. And if anything, a desire to hold on to these identities even more strongly. Those are some observations I come to with regard to the Remède de Fortune and its position as part of a legacy of treatment of this topic of the nature opening going back through the Trouvères.
And I guess finally, thinking even, you know, further ahead than the 14th century, you also relate the period that you're discussing to our current kind of climate anomaly. And I wondered if just in closure, you'd like to talk a bit about the where you see points of difference and similarity between our present and the medieval past that you're looking at so carefully.
Well, the first thing I'll say is that we don't really understand the present and we don't know what the future holds. So we have to keep that in mind. Obviously, our current situation is part of what drove my curiosity to learn more about the medieval climate anomaly and what Bruce Campbell calls the great transition to the Little Ice Age. Once the climate settles down, it settles into the Little Ice Age, this period in which overall patterns tend toward, you know, colder temperatures in Europe. And so it obviously kind of prompted my curiosity to learn more about this. I don't go quite to the present. In my conclusion, I do relate this to a more historically proximate example, and that is Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac. And so in particular, I kind of relate the material of the book to his chapter July, which is very famous. So the Sand County Almanac basically goes through the months of the year and notes kind of ecological relationships on the author's land, seasonal change, his interrelationship with this biotic community, as he calls it. But in the chapter of July, we find playful imagery of medieval lordship, and it shines very clearly through the text. As a medievalist, it's impossible not to notice it. And so I bring that book into mind at the very end, just to remind us how much our images of ourselves and our relationship to the land often bear echoes of the past. And I would imagine, you know, I'm just looking at medieval France and echoes of this in a modern, you know, American writer in the tradition of environmental writing. But I would imagine this is true for many cultures, you know, all over the world, that views we think of as modern ones often have a long legacy that we may be more or less aware of, and that they impact how we think about our relationships to land in the future, whether we realize it or not. And so if this book has something small to say about that, then I'll be happy.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. This has been such a fantastic discussion. And I really hope that all of our listeners go out and check out your book and either get a copy or encourage their institutional libraries to get one. It's a really fabulous contribution to the field. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Anya. It's been a pleasure.